which we can handle it without asking the Congress for too much relief, or if we do, I making it easy for the Congress to act by having our act together better at home, certainly than we had it in the past in dealing with the major legislation of the past. And I think that's about all I would like to cover at this time, having covered just about everything I can think of.
Well, thank you, Mr. Parker. When I was introducing you all, I introduced those who we were expecting, and Mr. Johnson, Chairman of Bering Straits Regional Corporation and Chairman of the Alaska Federation of Natives, has arrived. And Mr. Hope, I apologize. When I was introducing everybody, I had become so used to seeing you there that I neglected to introduce you, and I forgive me. Mr. Hope is well known to you all, President of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council and co-chairman of the Alaska Federation of Natives. And Rosita Worrell and Chuck Smythe are working with the commission, and David Case will be arriving later. He is teaches at the University at Fairbanks and is giving legal advice to the commission. I've told Byron Malott and Guy Martin that I would ask them to follow Walter Parker, and before they do, might I just ask you to consider some questions that have arisen in my mind, and I'm not suggesting you should address these, but you might want to say something about them later on. I know that some of you were engaged in writing ANCSA or ANILCA, or advising those who were writing ANCSA and ANILCA, and you might comment on what Walter Parker said in his paper about choosing fee simple as the form of holding a form of land tenure, and the institution of the corporation. Mr. Parker says that these are the two principal institutions of Western capitalism. He let the matter drop there. Is there anything further anyone would like to say about what that may express regarding Congress's intentions at the time? I wonder if you might also consider, when we began this morning, I indicated what the strengths of ANCSA clearly were, and what the weaknesses, as with the advantages of hindsight, people now see them, that is the transferability of shares. I'm not suggesting that is a weakness. That was a deliberate choice made back in 1971, but it is a matter of great objection in the villages, as far as I can tell. The liability to state income tax, state property tax, 20 years after conveyance. At the time, what was the purpose in making the shares transferable after 20 years? Perhaps you might also indicate whether the possibility of a state property tax being levied 20 years after conveyance is a real possibility. Does that really constitute a threat to the continued possession of these lands, assuming they are not by the land banking arrangements or some other means immunized from tax? What were the advantages as then perceived of these features, and how are they viewed now? And you might also comment on the fact that the only persons entitled to issuance of shares and to be enrolled in the corporations were the persons living, I think, at December 18th, 1971. That, as I told you earlier, is a subject of great concern in the villages, and was the subject of great concern to all who sat around this table the first 3 days of the week. Why was that done, and what were the advantages as then seen? I appreciate that many of these things occurred as the result of compromises that were felt to be to be altogether appropriate, and no one suggesting that they were not. But some people must have thought, well, this is a good idea, let's do it this way. And why was that? And the other point that Walter made, Walter Parker made, was and that I was startled by that figure in the paper last night about 56,000 people coming to Alaska in 1983, which means the native population, even though it's growing, becomes a smaller and smaller factor. And what are the implications of that? Perhaps, Mr. Malott, we could turn now to you and have your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciated reading Mr. Parker's paper, having had the opportunity and the honor to have worked with him on a number of issues like these in the past. And the issue of dealing with the institutions of the Claim Settlement Act is critical to any consideration of what the Act is and what it means and where it is at the current time. If I could characterize it at this moment, first backing up by saying that for all of its difficulties and for all the problems and flaws that we see, that ANCSA is very much an opportunity for Native people still, and that it is our task as Native people to create or seize the moral imperative to deal with those issues and develop the responses and the mitigation and the opportunities ultimately ourselves, and that there must be the assistance and the acquiescence and the participation of other institutions in order for us to achieve that. But the important point is that we have done it before, and I think that we can do it again. But I think that what we must get back to is being able to recognize our obligations in the sense of a moral imperative, as opposed to some fix-it of a piece of legislation that we have lived with for these many years. Looking at the federal versus state obligation, if you could characterize ANCSA as a group of people sitting around the table with a deck of cards, and people on one side of the table having been told, here is your opportunity to create something for yourselves and to control your own destiny, and the way we achieve it is by playing this game, and Native people are on one side of the table and Uncle Sam was on the other, well, in my judgment, we have unfinished business with the federal government because Uncle Sam slipped the winning ace up his sleeve. In Walt Parker's paper, in his summation, he mentions that, for example, referring to the people of Tununuk, who are one of the most remote groups and villages in Alaska, the sole assurances in the relationship of that small band of people to that piece of earth they have made so uniquely their own. Well, I submit that under the current corporate circumstances, that land is not their own. That as a matter of fact, they do not have ownership of that land. The ownership of that land is vested in corporations. And the obligations and the function of the corporation ultimately is to use that land for different purposes fundamentally from the purposes that the people of Tununuk ultimately acquiesced in the corporations acquiring that land. And I think that that is something that we have to deal with. In the institutions of ANCSA, the corporations and the question of sovereignty, we have mentioned several times, or it has been a recurring theme thus far, that sovereignty was not an issue that was dealt with. And while ANCSA in the preamble speaks quite clearly to such issues as not desiring to create continuing perpetual racial institutions, and ANCSA was clearly meant to propel Native people into the mainstream and to use mainstream kind of institutions in order to exercise self-sufficiency and control over their own destinies. As I said, I think Uncle Sam slipped an ace up his sleeve. And here's where I think it happened. The institution was the corporation. And the corporation comes with a lot of baggage. It also comes with incredible opportunity. And I want to emphasize that, because when we get into conversations like this, we usually spend a whole lot of time emphasizing the negative. But if ultimately Native people are to achieve the status that they aspire to, they must have economic strength in some form or another. And they must exercise that on an institutional as well as an individual basis. And in ANCSA, we have a very unique opportunity to do that, in my judgment. However, at the time of ANCSA, as we've discussed before, there were created expectations which have proven clearly to have been beyond the capability of any single institution to be meaningfully responsive to. In addition, because those expectations flowed from ANCSA, the institutions that were created by ANCSA became the focus and the measure by which the aspirations of Native people were viewed against. And of course, no single institution can do and be responsive to that level of expectation. The expectation was created, and then the opportunity to meet the expectation through the institutions was thwarted in several major respects, and for mostly very good reasons: to achieve democracy, to allow Native people at the most remote level to participate in the Claims Settlement Act. But that $1 billion and that 44 million acres of land was spread among more than 60,000 people on a per capita basis, partially. It was spread among over 200 corporations, and ultimately on an individual basis, it made any near-term opportunity to meet the expectations virtually impossible. The business of sovereignty, to get back to it just for a moment, the issue was left on the table, but with the institutions that were created, and I guess, speaking for myself, I did not see it clearly at the time, but while sovereignty was essentially left and not addressed in any four square sort of way, except by the references that I made earlier to trying to develop and utilize these kinds of institutions. If at 1991 these institutions don't do what Native people want them to do, we will have lost sovereignty as a practical effect of ANCSA. That is, we may still exist as Indian people, we may still have the values, we may still have aspirations, we still may maintain a unique identity, but the institutions that were created and the monetary and land settlement that was established will have reached a point wherein Native people will have lost a very incredible kind of opportunity. And in my judgment, that would be a very, very severe blow to the aspirations of Native people as far as sovereignty may have levers and power to really manifest itself and to be meaningful over a long period of time. And to get back to the Tununuk ownership of land, people who reside on the land may feel that that land is buffered, to use Walt's phrase. And it is, and it has been, and I think that that has been one of the glowing successes of the Claims Settlement Act, is that from day one, corporations have had the opportunity, and in many instances, the economic imperative to divest themselves of that land, and they have not. And these many years after the implementation, or after the passage of the Claims Settlement Act, virtually all native lands that were conveyed and are still being conveyed under ANCSA are still in the possession and ownership of native people. But in an institutional sense, those native people who feel that that land is theirs and that the corporations are merely stewards, to use a phrase that Mr. Borbridge used yesterday, and that our obligation is not to liquidate, our obligation is not to create burdens upon the land from economic use. What the corporations are and what they must do if we continue on our course is very much different from that. And those people in Tununuk, while they will have some opportunity to make a judgment at 1991 if nothing is changed between now and then on the surface estate of their land, will have no say, at least will not be able to have the ultimate say in what happens to the subsurface estate of their land. And as I said yesterday, Mr. Chairman, that if we proceed as we are to 1991, with Native people and minority people generally being in a position where, again, from my own perspective, public policy is creating a circumstance wherein minority and economically disadvantaged people are being presented with fewer opportunities in terms of broad public policy for advancement than was the case in the mid-1960s, and that we cannot expect the kind of significant social and economic advancement that we have seen during that period of time and to some degree subsequently, that 1991 is not really a choice. Because if people do not have economic freedom, they cannot make a free economic choice. And I think that that is a very major difficulty with the institutions of ANCSA as we look at 1991. The question of what these institutions are and what they can be and where they've been, and what, most importantly, what we expected of them at the time is also, in my judgment, very different from our expectations at the time of ANCSA. And again, I speak only from my personal feelings and sense at the time, and those were that we had the opportunity, and if you'll recall, those of you who were there, ANCSA at the time and subsequently has been characterized as a major social and economic experiment, unique in the annals of U.S. history. I bought that concept, and I thought that the corporate vehicle, the legal corporate structure, could be used to do more than traditionally it had done, that it could be more than just an economic institution, that it could influence by our having control of the institution, political and social and other issues beyond just the economic. And at least my experience subsequently has been that that is very difficult to do. Corporations demand an incredible sense of discipline and economic focus in order to be competitive on the business side. And the utilization of corporate assets require that almost all of those assets be employed in some sort of economic kind of activity. And the demands upon the management and the policymakers of those institutions are so much demanding of continuing an almost pure focus on economic and business kinds of activities that over time other priorities and other obligations, if you're not careful, begin to fade. And in my judgment also, that is a difficulty that we face as a people. However, I would once again qualify, or at least present the caveat, Mr. Chairman, that the corporate institution is not the answer to our problems. And if we do it right, it can be a very, very incredible option and opportunity for Native people in the future to attain economic strength. But so long as the land, which most Native people at the time felt was given to the corporations as stewards for some long-term, Native-oriented, subsistence-oriented, tribal-oriented, culturally-oriented purpose, is retained in ownership of the corporations, I think we have a major difficulty. Because at 1991, as I mentioned before, if you sell your stock, you sell your land. And I can recall, you know, one of the battle cries in the days of land claims was, take our land, take our life. And if you can move that into the future, you might be able to, at this point, say, take our stock, take our land, take our life. And I think that that is one of the dilemmas that Native people are facing at this point as we look at continuing implementation of ANCSA. But having said that, Mr. Chairman, I think that it's important to point out, as I did, that the corporations, for all of the pressures upon them, for economic success, have retained ownership of the land. And they've done it because of the strong sense that they are stewards. But the question becomes, how long can that be maintained with the business and legal imperatives and obligations that corporations have as institutions have upon them. The question of whether the state or the federal government is ultimately the proper forum or the political institution for the most significant relationship for the future of Native peoples is, I think, very much an open one still. Because, you know, we are faced with, in this decade, declining state revenues, unless we find other sources of revenues of a very substantial nature. And I'm not talking about the need for state funding for the sorts of purposes that a lot of people quickly assume when Native people begin talking about government and its obligations to Native people. I'm looking at it in broader public terms. because what has happened at the federal governmental level in the past several years with the major reprioritization of federal spending could very well happen in this state. And as we look to issues like subsistence, as we look to governmental issues such as Mr. Parker raised, and we juxtapose what might result from state public policy in the next decade, when we juxtapose that against the aspirations of Native people, I think that that it gives us, or it should give us, pretty substantial pause. The thought that Native people might be asking for something outside the purview of ANCSA through the work of this commission, the work that the Alaska Federation of Natives has undertaken for the past 3 years and is continuing on looking at 1991, the efforts that corporations themselves are involved with in trying to come to grips with the issue of 1991, that these efforts are somehow outside the scope of the game, that you people got what you got, and what do you want further, is not appropriate, and as a matter of fact, is also outside the spirit of ANCSA, because built into ANCSA itself were several opportunities for adjustment to the legislation as it affected Native people in its implementation. There was a 2C study, there was a 1985 study, and the clear intent was that we would look at ANCSA at certain periods and see whether it was doing what it was meant to do and what the Native people wanted it to do. And of course, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned yesterday and was pointed out by others, was that a lot of doors had shut from 1966 when this began to 1972 when the 2C study was done, and I think will be shut again when we look at the 1985 study in terms of public attitudes, in terms of public policy, in terms of governmental priorities. And I think that that makes it all the more incumbent upon us as Native people to spend a lot of time looking at these institutions that ANCSA has created and with which we have lived, and in the spirit of a moral imperative, as I said, and in the spirit of unity, look to how we can make it more able to deal with the aspirations and needs of Native people, and to do that in the time frame that allows us to respond positively and in our own terms to what otherwise could be a very significant difficulty if the choices have to be made in 1991. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Malott. Might I just suggest that in that very thoughtful presentation, a number of questions arise, but two of them occur to me, since this may come up again over the next 3 days, I take the liberty of mentioning it now. Mr. Malott suggested that the corporations may not be the appropriate vehicle for holding and managing ancestral lands, that is, lands that Native people want used and dedicated to subsistence uses. If they are not, then what sort of vehicle is? During the first 3 days here, it will not come as any surprise to anyone, the suggestion that IRA councils or traditional councils should be the vehicles for holding the land came up. I suggested that that no doubt deserves investigation, but it also deserves every a good look to make sure that, as Mr. Malott said yesterday, you're not exchanging one set of problems for another set. And we have Native leaders and scholars from the Lower 48 coming here next Tuesday for 4 days to talk about their experience in the Lower 48 with IRAs. Mr. Paul, who has extensive experience in these matters, gave made an appeal for IRAs, and I'd like those of you who wish to do so to tell us the disadvantages you see in that kind of arrangement. And you might also tell us what other possibilities there may be if you accept Mr. Malott's premise. The other point and that Mr. Malott's presentation gives rise to if is that if the corporations are shorn, so to speak, divested of some of their land, and it is turned over to some other entity, traditional council, IRAs, whatever, then that presumably weakens their economic position and the political influence that flows from that. And that's a consideration. I there's all kinds of questions bound up in that, but perhaps you'd park it in the back of your heads, and we might be able to address it a little later. I'm going to ask Mr. Guy Martin to follow. Yes, you're over there now.
Thank you, Judge. I'm not sure it's the best idea that I follow Byron, because I felt like he was reading from my sheet there for a little while. I know we share a good number of these ideas, and let me just first say, because this is my first day here, how nice it is to be back and be associated with this this whole issue again, and with some awfully good people, some of whom I haven't seen for a long time. Rather than try to go over some of the remarks that Byron made, with which I agree, let me try to supplement them in some ways. The thing that came to my mind, first of all, when I started thinking about your mission, Judge Berger, and the mission of this commission, was to try to put the Settlement Act in some perspective in this year, you know, standing as it does several years away from what everyone regards as the next major event in the development of the law. And although it's an obvious thing to say, it seems to me it's important to realize that the Settlement Act has escaped a fate that many other Indian laws have not escaped, and that is that it has never been a static law. And for those who work with Indian law regularly, and I'm really not one of those, but those who do know that they are among the most difficult to process in Congress, the most contentious, the most likely to break down in stalemate. Yet, from the very beginning, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act has never become such a law. And I think it can be said with absolute certainty that there were those at the time, and I'm sure that everyone is probably mulling over the name of Wayne Aspinall in the back of their mind when I say that, absolutely intended that the Settlement Act would be passed and never raised again, that it would create a set of immutable rules for the future of Alaska Natives, and it would not be revisited except in the most serious of circumstances. So what happened at the time is that some people walked away from that law, I think, believing that it was locked in time. It was a statute that essentially set the ground rules out, and that would be the conditions under which Alaska Natives would make or break their future. What we found, obviously, is that the later amendments, and there have been several, have been absolutely critical in not necessarily disclosing flaws in the Act, but simply addressing problems that were not easy to fully understand at the time the law was passed. And while there has been a charge each time the law has been amended that the natives are coming in and changing the rules, or someone else is coming in and changing the rules. In fact, the problems that have been addressed by and large have been serious issues that have been discovered through experience in the intervening years. And things like the land bank and the subsistence provision are fine examples of addressing those kinds of issues. In the future, we look out there and we have to deal with the taxation issue, the submerged lands issue, the stock alienation issue, and all the others that many of you know so well. The important thing to say is that while those are tough issues, all of those we're discussing, they're very much on the agenda. They're live issues and they're capable of being solved. And I think the people who consciously sought to make the Settlement Act an open, dynamic, living law ought to be commended for doing so. And there were some people who took a particularly active role in pressing that point particularly. I might say that the same kind of logic is clearly going to attempt to be applied to the Alaska Lands Act, which deals with the conservation units in Alaska. And all of us will probably have to face up to the issue of whether or not we try to lock that act in time or not. In terms of the issues that have been raised that change over the years, I would just observe that many of the issues which we now regard as the serious make or break issues for Alaska Natives were certainly not discussed in detail at the time the initial act was passed. And some of them, at least in my recollection, which was sort of a junior gatekeeper for one member of the delegation, were really never raised in any serious way. And I suspect that by and large those issues were not raised because they really weren't understood and weren't known. I've tried fairly hard, but on my best day, I find it very difficult to construct any kind of a conspiratorial theory with regard to the corporate form that's used in the act, or any of the other major ingredients of the structure which was established. There are stories that many of us know as to how some of these provisions got in the act or how we think they were affected in the act, and I'm sure we can tell some of those during our sessions, but I cannot create any evidence that makes me believe that there was anything more serious than a lack of knowledge or foresight in creating that structure. The best example of the issues that were not well known or well thought through and certainly not well discussed, as far as I'm concerned, are all the issues that relate to village power and the place in which the role that the villages would play in the future of this new structure that was being created under the terms of the settlement. And I've told this story before, and it's only the personal recollection of one person working in a reasonably good vantage point for one member of our delegation. And it was that in terms of your questions with regard to how fee simple and the corporate form was adopted and some of the other structural aspects of the act, the issue of regions versus villages and the issue of fee versus trust lands, for instance, was simply not raised very much in any of the hearings. It was probably raised to some extent because I think there were witnesses that talked about it, but it was not raised in a high-profile way in any of the hearings or major discussions of the act, so far as I recall, in 1970 and 71, and I feel confident not too much before that. At the very end of the consideration of the act in 71, as it sort of wound down to this climactic enactment, there was, I perceived, a very pronounced growth in attention to the village issues and a very pronounced growth in advocacy of the trust land issues and a pronounced in growth in the intensity of village advocacy in Congress. And by that I mean people just started showing up in greater numbers wanting to talk about those issues, and they were not a part of the representative hierarchy of the AFN at that time, nor were they really felt to be sort of dastardly interlopers. They were simply there talking about, asking about, and advocating village issues. That discussion essentially was snuffed out, and I mean that not pejoratively in the least. It was essentially ended by passage of the act. And the act passed really as that discussion was starting to develop in a much more significant way. Had the act not passed, and in some respects, as many of you know, there were many, many chances for it not to pass in 1971. Had it not passed that year, I suspect that had we all been dealing with it in 72 and 73, that the issues of the village role and the issue of trust ownership of land would have played a significantly greater part in the passage of the Settlement Act. And I'd be very interested to hear if other people had a similar or completely different experience. The other issue that's been discussed, and it was on my agenda to mention, although it was certain to come up, is this issue of the corporate structure. When I look back over this same terrain that Byron described to try to appreciate what's happened with the Act over all these years, the most striking feature of the entire experience to me is the perfection with which the corporate structure has been established, not only as a management form, but as a kind of mentality, a kind of identity that has been infused into the settlement and the way in which the settlement's been realized. Again, this is where it's most tempting to try to devise some kind of a conspiratorial theory that someone thought that this form would somehow be good for unquestioned and unfettered Alaska development in the future by essentially tying natives to a series of corporate forms. But as I say, I don't think there's any case to be made for that. To the contrary, I think that what happened, Judge Berger, in answer to your question, is that among several forms which are considered at the time, that was considered the major and best alternative to others, many of which were not discussed in great detail. But the major form which was certainly on view as the alternative was the experience of the lower 48 reservations and trust relationship with the federal government. And so people sort of internalized their feelings about that, had views about it, many of which were not discussed in detail in the hearings, and decided that as the best alternative, the corporate structure was the alternative to choose. It's probably also important to say, and certainly all the people in this room know the dynamics of the time, that what you had in 1968 or 69 or before was a claim, a massive claim, which was certainly being perfected, not only in terms of developing the legal case for the claim, but it was being perfected in the sense that a growing body of public knowledge of the claim, public acceptance of the claim, and sort of general momentum was being gathered, particularly during the latter part of the 60s. There's no telling when that claim might have been settled, absent other external developments. Certainly it would have been pressed and it would have been moved forward, but there's no doubt that as everyone knows, that the discovery of oil and the potential of building the Alaska pipeline and the land freeze and all of the elements that went into forcing that choice created a situation in which a bargain could be struck. And as I see it, that bargain was one essentially in which the natives were presented with a series of alternatives to settle, most of which revolved around the central idea of changing their claims, which were non-productive resources in the present sense, into productive resources. That is, land owned in fee simple, and money to develop that land, and a structure which permitted them to develop it. And looking at the movement of non-productive, economically productive claims into productive ownerships of various types and structures of various types, the corporate fee simple model, which Walt correctly says are sort of the foundations of Western capitalism, were chosen simply because they're the foundations of Western capitalism. And that's a real good reason if what you're doing is trying to create productivity. Having said that, I join with Byron in lamenting the baggage that comes with that and sort of admiring the perfection with which that corporate structure has created not only what it should have done, that is an efficient way to manage resources and develop them and hopefully return a fair return on capital to the holders of the resources, but it, I think, has infused, in many cases, the entire community and the awareness of the community with a with an identity which is not simply a secondary or complementary identity, but in many cases a dominant and in some cases sort of an exclusive identity for dealing with issues that may be Native issues. And I know that from time to time Byron and a number of others in the Native community have spoken out on this and spent time trying to think through how you deal with that and maintain the central values of being a Native at the same time you're doing what corporations are supposed to do. And I think you're right in identifying the fact that in corporations, non-economic actions are certainly permissible, but they are always second priority. I think that's the best way to see it. You can't make them first priority and succeed. Even ARCO quits giving money to the arts when oil prices go down. And they're very honest about why they do it. They don't have any extra money to do it. They'd rather use it in their drilling program, and it's just that simple. To mention two last things in brief, one of my passions over the years, as many people here know, has been the Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Program, which, as I see it, is essentially an issue in which the federal government is pressing a relatively aggressive leasing program on the state, basically in response to an industry which wants, and understandably wants, acreage for drilling. And they will press for as much acreage as they can get. That's their job, their corporations. The federal government has generally been responsive to that, and they like the revenues that that program brings in. It's the biggest single producer revenue for the federal government except for taxes. I think the corporate structure in ANCSA has, to a large extent, affected the way in which not only the natives but the state has dealt with that issue, in the sense that alone among all the coastal areas of the United States, and by that I mean the California area, the New England area, and the sort of Florida area, and I exclude the Gulf, which is sort of a previously developed area in which offshore leasing comes somewhat comfortably, alone among all the undeveloped areas, Alaska's been singularly unsuccessful in creating any kind of a unified position, not to oppose that program, but to modify it and to moderate it and to win changes. And I think